So we're going to jump right into Ecclesiastes chapter 7, and we're going to cover this chapter this week. We're not going to read a lot of the chapter, but I'd certainly encourage you to read through the full chapter. But to jump right in Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 1, in the beginning half of that verse, Solomon writes, "A good name is better than fine perfume." And in lots of ways, this opening line is sort of a perfect summation of chapter 7. And it was tempting for this to be the only verse that we look at today, because if we really think about what Solomon's saying here, and we don't just kind of gloss over it, this idea that a good name is better than fine perfume is something that's pretty profound and instructive for our lives this morning. The truth is this, that fine perfume, fine scent, something that smells nicely, is a really good thing to have. A pleasant smell has the ability to make people feel a sense of attraction to you. It has the ability to cover over other issues that are going on. If we think about the benefits of a fine perfume or a fine smell, it has this ability to provide a sense of comfort to you. If we went around the room and asked people to share about smells that they find pleasant, there might be people who would talk about, you know, maybe that perfume or cologne that their spouse or the person that they love wears that gives them that sense of comfort. A lot of people would talk about, you know, things like walking into a relative's house and in the scent that it has and the feeling of familiarity and comfort that provides. For some people, it would be maybe a certain kind of food where whenever you hit that, it brings up all of this kind of memory of the past and comfort that comes from that. There are tons of different ways. A field of fresh flowers. When you go camping and that kind of that dewy scent that happens in mountain air or in the forest. There are all of these sort of very pleasant scents and that we experience and these positive associations that we have with smell. And there's also quite a bit of negative associations that we have with smell as well. If a person walks into a room and it smells badly, there's oftentimes like a physical sense of repulsion that you feel where you just want to get out of that kind of place until your nose acclimates to that. I can recall this moment, and I always think about this with bad smells, where there was this time when I was living in this house that had a garage that was kind of underneath the main living area of the house, and I'd been gone for 2 weeks in the summer, and so I had been at a youth camp and then been leading a missions trip, and so I pulled into my garage and something smelled awful. And I couldn't figure out what it was, but I lived on the edge of woods, and so I remember thinking, like, did something get, like, stuck in here and die? It was that kind of a smell, like something died sort of smell. And so I looked through the garage, and I couldn't find anything, and then I went into the house, and the smell was, it was much tamer throughout the house, but it wasn't really completely gone in the house anywhere, and so I could kind of smell it all over, and then I thought, where is this smell coming from? And I started looking around outside the house to again see if something had died in my backyard. And then I went back into the garage and I knew this is definitely where this is coming from. And as I started kind of looking around the garage, I saw that a chest freezer that was full of venison had kicked off at some point in the midst of a hot summer while I was out of town for 2 weeks. And so when I mustered up that kind of courage and rubber gloves to open that up, it was awful and disgusting. And the thought of that smell, it made my stomach turn a little bit just kind of thinking about it for this morning. It happened again last night. I was in the middle of sort of a cold sleep, and I started having this weird dream that a skunk was following me. And maybe you smelled it when you came here this morning, and then I woke up and it smelled like skunk, because we have a neighborhood skunk that will make its rounds every once in a while. And so I was dreaming about a skunk, and when I woke up, there was a skunk smell in our bedroom. It wasn't a dream. It was a reality. And we have these things, that happen in life where a negative smell gives us this strong kind of negative connection, and a positive smell gives us this positive connection. And Solomon explains for us in the beginning of this chapter that it is better to be known for living well than it is for smelling well. that it's more important for us to be people that live well than it is for us to be people that smell well. And it smells silly for us to even kind of say that. Because on one level we'd say, of course it's better to be a good person than it is to wear a nice perfume or cologne or whatever kind of scent you want. And sometimes we can easily forget that daily bathing and hygiene is a relatively recent progression in human history. And it isn't present all over the world, but even in our culture. That 100 years ago, the way a family would bathe themselves is that they'd fill up the tub from outside, and then, starting with the parents, one by one, families that are larger typically than our families today, would all bathe in that same water. So you'd have 7 or 8 people bathing in one tub water, and it was disgusting if we think about it now. But that was the way that people used to live in America 100 years ago. If we think about this idea, when Solomon is writing to them and he's saying, look, the reality is this, that it's better to be people who are living well than it is to be people who are smelling well. What he's really saying is that it's better to be people who are living a good life than it is to be people who have the kind of wealth and status and ability to be able to cover up their scent. To be able to appear attractive to other people. I think for us, if Solomon were alive today, we could kind of translate this culturally, and I say maybe for us, maybe we could translate this culturally to say something along the lines of, a good life is better than a good Facebook life. The way that we actually live our lives is more important than the way that we're able to make our lives look to other people, than the masks that we're able to wear for other people. A life of substance, a life where we're concerned with living well, is more important than being a person of vanity that puts in all kinds of effort into the appearance of looking or smelling well. This is a message that many of us need to hear each day. And I'm thankful that many of us probably also showered last night or this morning, but what Solomon says to us is that it would be better for there to be a little bit of funk in the room this morning and for us to be living good lives than for us to be the kind of people who dress ourselves up, but on the inside we're shallow, vain, meaningless people kind of living a meaningless experience. And in reality, much of the rest of chapter 7, it focuses in on this idea that a good name is better than fine perfume. And he goes on in verse 1, to finish verse 1, to say this, that the day of death is better than the day of birth. And this statement seems to make significantly less sense to us. It's easy for us to draw that first kind of connection, and we can agree that smelling nice is good, but having a good name, a reputation for doing good, a positive legacy is more important. But it's a little bit more difficult to agree to this idea that somehow the day of death may be better than the day of birth. Many of us, even if you are not a parent, have witnessed that kind of magic, that holy moment of new life. That moment when a parent for the first time gets to hold their child. And then a little bit later, oftentimes that day, when a child will get introduced to its family, when a grandparent's able to hold their grandchild, when an aunt and uncle are able to meet their new niece or nephew, when a sibling is able to meet their new brother or sister. There's a really special, kind of beautiful moment that takes place on the day of birth. And yet Solomon, he says for some reason that the day of death is better than the day of birth. When we celebrate new life, there's this sense of joy and gratitude and excitement. And words like that would rarely ever be used to describe the day of death. When we think about the mourning that takes place in death, we don't think of things like joy or excitement or gratitude. We don't have that overwhelming kind of sense of emotion. There's sadness that's overwhelming. There's the feeling of loss that's overwhelming. If we go back to kind of the hospital room, which for us is typically where we have both the day of birth and the day of death today. If you've been in the room when a family member passes away, or a friend, someone that's loved passes away and family and friends are there, it's a time that's mourning, full of mourning. It's a time that has denial. It's a time that has sadness. It's a time where it's hard to reconcile what you're experiencing in your mind and what's taking place. So why would Solomon say that the day of death is better than the day of birth? I think for us to make any sense of this, we have to read it in that context of the beginning half of verse 1, that a life well lived is better than the smell of fine perfume. Because there's no real argumentation, there's no suggestion that somehow death is better than life. He doesn't make that point anywhere. He doesn't say that. He doesn't try to advance some kind of argument about that. But what he is saying here is that when we go to someone on the day of their death, rather than on the day of their birth, we have clarity about the kind of life that they lived. We can really evaluate at that point if someone had a good name. In the moments and days of kind of recovery after birth, there's this wonder when you look at a baby and when you think about what kind of person that baby is going to become. And there's this, this kind of this holiness in that sort of moment for parents and grandparents as they wonder, what kind of person is this baby going to become? How kind and how intelligent and how much potential do they have in all kinds of ways? There's this dreaming that takes place in that sort of process about the unknown elements that will exist in their future. But when a person passes away, the dreaming isn't there because the clarity is there. We might not say it right in that moment of someone's passing, but when someone passes, oftentimes what happened is that once people work through the emotions of that person passing away, they remember the kind of life that the person who died lived. They remember things about their life, and they forget the vain things, like about how they smelled or what kind of perfume they wore, and that can linger for a while, but they remember those things of substance about that person's life. They remember the way that a person made them feel. They remember a way that a person interacted with them. They remember both positively and negatively. Maybe, sharp words from that person or words of loving kindness in a moment of brokenness. Those are the kinds of things that on the day of death, that aren't left to kind of question and wonder about. There's a sense of clarity that when we pass away, we leave a legacy to the people who are behind us. We leave a legacy to people that we interacted with in our life. And so Solomon says this, that when someone passes away, there's clarity to the kind of life that they lived. And as a result, he says that in that kind of sense, the day of death is better than the day of birth. And he goes on to say this. In verse 2, he says, it is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. For death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. And in verse 4, he says, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. And the rest of chapter 7 really lays out this sort of dichotomy for us, that there are two ways that we can live in this life. And the first way is this, that we can live with the acknowledgement of death that leads us to a better life. Or the opposite of that, that we can live with ignorance towards death and that leads us to a meaningless life. And we're actually going to begin by focusing in on this second point and then we'll come back to the first point. But the statement, ignorance is bliss, is something that many of us have echoed throughout life. We echo it when we learn something about a person that we didn't want to know. We echo it when we learn something about, like, the way that hot dogs are made. We echo this idea that there's a blissfulness in not knowing things that we don't want to know. But we can pretty much all agree that living in ignorance isn't really a reality for us. And that living in ignorance isn't actually a good way for us to live. And so these words in Ecclesiastes accurately call us to to consider the strange reality that happens, that many of us choose to live in blissful ignorance that someday we will pass away from this life. That the overwhelming odds are that at the end of our lives, we will die. And this is the reason for many of us, many people, why, you know, there's that experience where families will throw a big, like, over-the-hill kind of birthday party for you with black balloons, and they'll give you cards that joke around about your death. And then for some people, that kind of works into their psyche. There's this idea, oh my goodness, I'm going to die, and I haven't lived the kind of life that I wanted to live. People go through these moments where they think about things that they wanted to do when they were younger and they never had the chance to do, places they wanted to visit and they never made it to, the things that they maybe really wanted to try, but they kind of didn't have enough courage or ability or opportunity to be able to try something. And so this thing happens for lots of people that someday you wake up and you have this realization that there are less days in front of you than there are behind you in all likelihood. And for some people, that recognition, that moment when the ignorance of death wears off, becomes a very difficult moment because they realize they haven't been living the kind of life that they should be living. And some people exercise that in all kinds of inappropriate ways in the middle of their life. But the reality that Solomon is revealing to us here is that we should be people, regardless of our age, that remember as we live life that there's an end coming to that life. That there's a legacy that we're building. And there are four things, really, that one commentator pointed out. There are ways that people choose to be ignorant towards death. There are ways that people choose to ignore this coming reality of death. And we see these things highlighted in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. And so one of the ways that we pursue this ignorance, and we've hit on several of these things already, so we're going to kind of work through most of them pretty quickly. One of the ways that we pursue ignorance towards our death is through personal gain. In verse 7, Solomon says, "Extortion turns a wise person into a fool, and a bribe corrupts the heart." And we've talked about injustice towards others. We've talked about the unhealthy pursuit of money where we take advantage of others. And Solomon hits on this here again. When we are not living wisely with the end of our lives in mind, then we're prone to pursue our personal gain and to live in a way that devalues other people and in a way that lives at the expense of other people. And so he says this, that extortion turns a wise person into a fool. When we live for personal gain, we live in a way that's foolish. The second is this. He talks about this idea of impatience in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. In verse 8, it says, "The end of a matter is better than its beginning, and patience is better than pride." This seems a little bit counterintuitive. It seems like living with that deadline in mind, living with our death in mind, would cause us to be less patient. It would cause us to kind of feel this sense of drive and that we have to get everything done now because there's this deadline in mind. Solomon goes back to this truth over and over again, that when we are so focused on living as well as we can here and now, that we oftentimes don't wait in order to get what it is that we want. That we oftentimes live with this sense of pride that we need to get everything that we're entitled to immediately and in that moment. And that this is the wrong way to live. That we need to develop a sense of patience in life. The third is this. This idea that many of us live with an unhealthy sense of anger. And that if we lived with the end of our lives in mind, we would realize that we need to let go of some of that anger that we experience. Verse 9 says, "Do not be quickly provoked in your spirit, for anger resides in the lap of fools." If we recognize that people around us are finite beings, and that we are finite beings, and that every time we have a conversation and an interaction with a person, it has the potential to be our last conversation or interaction with a person, it changes our tone that we have with them. It changes the way that we respond to situations. We probably wouldn't choose to explode in anger as often as we do if we live with this idea in mind that this could be the last time I talk to this person and that I'm leaving a legacy for this person. The first three verses seem to line up well with other elements of the book of Ecclesiastes, that we need to be people that don't live with towards our personal gain, that we need to be people that live with a sense of patience, that we shouldn't be people that respond or explode or blow up with anger. But there's a fourth idea that comes up in chapter 7 that's sort of a new idea for the book of Ecclesiastes, and that's this notion of nostalgia as a way that we live unwisely. In verse 10, he says, "Do not say, 'Why were the old days better than these?' For it is not wise to ask such questions." And you don't have to be very old to make a statement about the good old days. You know, you don't have to have lived very long to have this feeling that maybe things were better just a little while earlier. And as I read this passage, I thought about how incredible it is that thousands of years later, that different civilizations, that different languages have passed, that the world has gone through so much kind of change over the time since Solomon wrote this to our time today, and still we would express a sentiment like this almost word for word. Why were the old days better than these? Things aren't the way that they used to be. You know, we wax nostalgically about the way that things were back in our neighborhood or back when we were kids and we could do things differently than the way that kids are today. There's this sense, when we engage and talk like this, that we're living for the past instead of living in wisdom where we are, in recognition that where we are is where we've been placed, and that someday we're going to leave this place, and that we should be doing everything we can to make it better instead of looking back to the past. I was just having a conversation with a neighbor, and he's a kind guy, a guy that I really like and we'll talk to regularly, and as the kids were walking and the kids were away, we started talking about, you know, whatever the news topic of the day was. And he said, "Man, I'm glad that I do not have kids today that are growing up in the world that we experience." And that's something that we hear over and over and over again. And I thought, thanks. Thanks for that word of encouragement. But I thought that's something that we're often tempted to look at the past with this sense of rose-colored glasses. But when we do that, what we're actually doing is escaping reality of the present. And there's an author, Dan Gibson, who writes on the book of Ecclesiastes and this idea of living with an unhealthy sense of nostalgia. And he says that potentially Solomon, if he were talking with someone who said, "Why were the old days better than these?" he might say something like this: "If you think you are living in a world where things are getting worse all the time, then cheer up. At least you'll be dead before things get really bad." We have all of these ways as people that we put off death in our minds. We avoid the thought of it because it's unpleasant. We avoid the thought of it because it's often painful. We avoid the thought of it because it's a separation from everything that we've ever known, because it causes pain to people that we really love and care about most in this world. And yet, even with all of those things that are true, Solomon teaches us that being people that live with the consideration of the end of our lives helps us to live better lives here and now. That somehow we get this idea mixed up in our human nature that the way we can live the best life is to ignore death. But he says, no, the way that you can create a better name, the way that you can lead a better life, is when you keep that end of life in mind. Because when you do that, it reveals the things that are really important and the things that are these vain concerns that we allow to occupy our mind that we shouldn't give that space to. The vain pursuits that we allow to occupy our time that don't fulfill us. The vain things, the meaningless things that we encounter in life that we allow to cause us harm or joy that are fleeting. But in the end of the day, they don't amount to anything. People that live for all the pleasures and opportunities of this world suffer with meaninglessness, and others that live with death in mind will actually lead a better life. It sounds strange, but it reminds us of the important lesson that Solomon keeps coming back to in Ecclesiastes, that there is something to live for that is more important than what we see and encounter in the world around us. Mark chapter 8 in the Gospels, it's this incredible story and this glimpse into the life of Jesus. And when I say it's this glimpse into the life of Jesus, it has kind of a snapshot of so many different things that Jesus encountered in his time on earth. The chapter opens up with Jesus feeding the 5,000, so performing this incredible miracle. And then right after he feeds the 5,000, there's this moment where people who are critical and skeptical of Jesus, where they question him and ask him to perform a sign for them. And so I guess feeding 5,000 people wasn't enough, so they want another sign from him. There are these moments where Jesus heals a blind man. There's this the famous confession for Peter at Caesarea Philippi, where he acknowledges Jesus as the Messiah that's been promised. Jesus teaches and tells his disciples about going to the cross. There's a lot that is packed into Mark chapter 8. And there's one section where Jesus kind of expands on this idea from Solomon that if we're wise, we don't lead lives of vanity. We lead lives where we have the end in mind. When in verses 35 and 36, Jesus says this: "For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul?" Solomon says that when we live for things around us and we ignore our future reality, that we don't live in wisdom. That ignorance isn't as bliss. Jesus expands on that, and he makes it clear to this crowd that he's speaking to that they have a choice between living for themselves, living to gain the world, living for all the things that Solomon prescribes as meaningless, really, or to live for him. When we consider the ways that we live our lives, we need to be people that don't just ask the question, am I living with the end in sight, but that ask the question, am I living for anything other than Jesus and his gospel? Am I living for anything other than the life that has been provided? For us, Solomon kind of, he intros that sense of wisdom to us. Solomon makes it clear that there are things that are more important than the things that we see around us and the immediate pursuits that we have in life. That we're wise to be people that are concerned with living well more than with accruing wealth and misusing people and getting what we want in life. And then Jesus takes that one step further. And he explains that not only are we wise to kind of live with the recognition that there are more important things in life than our own gain, but that if we really want to experience life, we need to be people who are willing to lose our life for his sake and for the sake of the gospel. We have an opportunity in the days we have on earth to live for things of temporary meaning, or to live for the glory of God, to follow in the footsteps of Jesus by bringing his hope, his peace, his love, and his new life to the world around us. We should be people that look for ways to lose our lives for the sake of the gospel. We should be people that ask ourselves the question, am I seeking to gain the whole world, or am I seeking to pick up my cross and follow Christ?